It's the Burt Cohen Show. Always competing dreams, of course. That's what makes a democracy, what makes a republic. Luckily, we still have the possibility of having competing visions, competing parties, and different ways of approaching our problems and coming up with solutions. And one of the alleged big problems these days is America's debt. Our debt to foreign nations, people, interests that we borrow money from. And there is a group out now called Fix the Debt. Sounds innocuous enough. Fix the debt. Let's do something about it. We don't want to mortgage our future and put the burden down on my next generation and their next generation and their next generation for overspending today. We need to do something to fix the debt. Well, it's not necessarily so, as they used to say. Our guest today is Mark Provost, who will be talking about this group called Fix the Debt, what they are, what their agenda is, and what other options there may be for a stronger national economy. Mark Provost is Communications Director of Corporate Tax Accountability Group, U.S. Uncut. Mark's writing on U.S. income and wealth inequality have appeared in numerous publications, including Truthout, Institute for Policy Studies, and Counterpunch. Mark Provost, thanks very much for being with us today on The Burt Cohen Show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Burt. Glad to be on.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. And Robert Kuttner, who's a remarkably insightful editorial writer, columnist, he called Fix the Debt, quote, millionaires and billionaires telling the rest of America to tighten its belt for the greater good. Well, Mark, you have some knowledge of Fix the Debt. Who and what is Fix the Debt?
Well, I'd say Fix the Debt is the the latest group behind a longstanding effort. If you were to point out one individual, identify one individual most responsible for Fix the Debt and for the at least two decade long push to quote unquote reform Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that'd be Pete Peterson. So a lot of people are pretty familiar with the Koch brothers and their influence in the energy industry and their political influence. But Pete Peterson has a different approach. It's entirely bipartisan. So if a corporate member or a politician wants to be on Fix the Debt, then they have to make the number one qualification is that they have to be bipartisan. Not nonpartisan, but bipartisan. So the appearance that it is a bipartisan effort is probably the most unique to it. And it's been somewhat successful because of that. The Koch brothers get a lot of bad press because, they simply cater to one party.
Right.
Obama and Democrats can kind of, make a lot of to-do about them. But there's a lot of, bipartisan support in Fix the Debt. I'd say it's part of the Peterson push is what I call it, like the Coke-tipus. It has this long tentacles. So Pete Peterson has efforts, say, in the Concord Coalition that go back at least three decades.
Now, Pete Peterson, which corporation is he with? And I know his name keeps popping up on any number of incarnations of the same basic entity. He was influential behind the No Labels group, which... it sounded very similar. Actually, somebody before the show said, didn't you already do that? And the thing is, well, we've talked about no labels here on the Bert Cohen Show, but who is Pete Peterson and what is his real goal, do you think? And how is it, expand the question, how is it that he can attract Democrats as well as Republicans? I guess similar to what he did with no labels.
Yeah, that's exactly. With no labels, Concord Coalition, which was a little bit more Republican-leaning, and then also a short-lived initiative that immediately preceded Fix the Debt, which was called the Comeback in America Initiative, and that was led by David Walker, who was the former Comptroller General, a longtime associate and employee of Pete Peterson. But Pete Peterson is a private equity billionaire. He did work for some of the main institutions on Wall Street, but he's mostly known for his private equity work and amassed a considerable fortune. He's taken, I don't know the exact number, but it's, I think, $1 billion or close to $1 billion into these organizations, which critics claim are all about changing the fundamental nature of Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. Basically, you know, his critics charge he's trying to dismantle the safety net and using his private money to assemble allies in media, in Washington, in state legislatures. So he does have considerable influence.
And how far have they gotten so far in, well, for example, in lining up Democrats? And, you know, how can they attract this Democratic fix if they really are after Social Security?
Well, I don't think they've got the entirety of the Democratic Party, but there are people like Dick Durbin, for instance, who I think has been amenable to this Fix the Debt message. And so to be clear, Fix the Debt is the latest incarnation of this Pete Peterson project. In itself, its public face is over 100 CEOs at this point. So they've amassed the most powerful CEOs in the country. They have considerable political influence in themselves. So they're just basically hammering the case for, you know, that we find a bipartisan solution to Fix the Debt.
Right.
However, they don't really tell you that they're spending all their lobbying money to get huge corporate tax rates, corporate tax breaks at the same time. So, you know, and as far as the Democrats, I don't think that there's the entirety or the majority
No.
Democrats in Congress are behind his message. But I think, again, some of them are open to it.
Well, again, it sounds real nice. Ooh, the debt is a big problem. It's hanging over us. We want to be seen as doing something, and Fix the Debt sounds good. Similarly to no labels. Oh, people hate the ugly partisanship, and let's just, you know, play nice in the sandbox here and everybody get along. No labels sounded so good. But once again, it was something that was clearly trying to impose and make into law a certain agenda. What do they want to do with Social Security and Medicare? I know for years and years and years there's been talk of privatizing Social Security, which would be, of course, a disaster. It would put all that Social Security capital into private hands, and boy, we've seen how secure they aren't.
Right, but you know, that I think maybe would be the main push. But before that, there's all kinds of changes. And again, some of them have been embraced by even the president, like chain CPI, or means testing. So that's another really, I'd say, important goal. I'd say that's even more important than the privatization part, because they know that still is so unpopular. Not that means testing or chain CPI, but it's a little bit wonkish, so you can fool some people with it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, saying you're going to privatize the accounts and give them to Wall Street, you know, people can kind of wrap their heads around that.
Yes.
But, so there's all kinds of efforts to dismantle it, but the American people don't want it at all. They've always, polling always shows the Americans don't want the Social Security and Medicare cut at all, so.
But isn't Social Security, I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, isn't there a problem with the liquidity of Social Security going forth? There, when it was put in place in the 1930s, there were far fewer older people. People weren't living as long, so 65 was relatively old back then. But now, is there not a serious problem with Social Security? Isn't that something that the government should be focused on fixing that? And why not have means testing? People who, you know, don't need those Social Security checks, why not, you know, trim the budget a little bit that way?
Yeah, on the second point I'll take first, the reason why you don't want to introduce means testing is because that's the reason why Medicare and Social Security are far more popular programs than WIC or TANF or Section 8 housing. It's because it's universal and not means tested is the reason behind its huge popularity. You're talking about 85 to 87% of the American people look at Social Security favorably. So it's one of the most popular social programs. And something that has to be mentioned, it's one of the most effective anti-poverty programs. You know, before Social Security, 50% of American seniors lived in poverty. So more than half of American seniors lived in poverty. But after Social Security, that has been declining every single year since the Social Security Administration was formed in 1935. And now it's under 10%. In fact, seniors in America are the least impoverished group in the United States. There's a huge difference than 80 years ago. They were among one of the poorest. And that's because of Social Security. So it's just a very effective, very popular program. And I believe means testing sounds good. You know, if somebody earned $1 million, you know, a year, why should they get Social Security? Well,
yes.
The cost of giving that person Social Security is far less than introducing a means testing and thereby undermining the universal popularity and universal access to that program. But the Social Security problems, though, are we still have the Social Security still is running a surplus, and it does have a $2 trillion wealth fund that's mostly in U.S. Treasuries. So it has a huge, huge fund, and it's still running a surplus. Now, the future expected costs are almost entirely due to healthcare costs. But, you know, that's not a problem that's to Social Security. You know, that's a problem with our healthcare system. So,
and I always find it interesting that President Ronald Reagan, who is, of course, revered by the right wing, what's left of the Republican Party these days, he, back when he was president, he talked about Social Security being out of bounds when it comes to making budget cuts, that it's a separate fund, that the debt is not related specifically to Social Security, that it really, whatever spending is going on, it's a separate trust fund that, you know, isn't part of the problem. And here's Ronald Reagan saying that, and here, and now you have people saying, well, we got to focus on that. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Mark Provost, who is Communications Director of the Corporate Tax Accountability Group, U.S. Uncut. We're talking about the newish group, Fix the Debt, and what is the real problem with the debt. And as you've mentioned, that members of the Fix the Debt group, the heading it up, and the steering committee have deep ties to the financial industry. And there's a person named David Cote, who I believe is chief executive officer with Honeywell, which has a lot of tremendous contracts with the defense industry. Tell us about your action. You actually had some communication, I believe, with Mr. Cote quite directly.
Yeah, I mean, we at U.S. Uncut, we went with a new group called Flip the Debt. So we're trying to put the issue, elevate the issue of corporate tax avoidance, you know, on the agenda, in saying that if entitlements need to be cut, it should be the entitlements of corporate welfare. So, and then we partner with a lot of local groups too, and we went down there and David Cote was at a Fix the Debt meeting. And we interrupted him shortly after he began his speech, and we told the room about how Honeywell is the 35th largest federal contractor, so it receives hundreds of millions of dollars from the government, and yet over the last few years, Honeywell's paid less than 2% tax. And yet here, this the CEOs here saying that we're going to we have a debt problem, and he's suggesting we solve it by cutting Social Security and Medicare. So, I mean, it's like an arsonist, like a serial arsonist, showing up and giving lessons on how to, you know, prevent home fires. It's totally it's totally delusional.
And who is Jim McCrary? I hope I have that pronounced right. He's pushing to maintain low tax rates on dividend income, and he's got something called the Win America Campaign, which is a coalition of multinational corporations lobbying for a one-time repatriation holiday. I wonder if you could tell us about Jim McCrary and what he's up to and what his role may be with Fix the Debt.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Win America, if I'm not mistaken, it was disbanded a few months ago, but it was again one of these ad hoc groups that was pushing for repatriation of foreign profits. Now, a couple things need to come up here. So corporations have $1.7 trillion held abroad. U.S. tax rules, it's not really a special loophole at all. It's always been in existence. If you don't get taxed on your foreign profits until you repatriate them, meaning you bring them back to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if a corporation has a foreign subsidy, it can hold its earnings in that subsidy or in a foreign bank in perpetuity without getting taxed. Now, the system that the multinationals are advocating is a territorial system. They only want to be taxed on the U.S. profits. But here's the problem here. This $1.7 trillion in profits that's held abroad, it wasn't entirely made or even the majority made overseas. These are overseas profits that much of them were made. The products themselves were assembled in the United States. They were consumed in the United States. It's simply by tax avoidance laws and practices known as transfer pricing, which allow companies to allocate their costs in high-tax countries and allocate profits in low-tax countries like the Cayman Islands in Ireland. But in no way, shape, or form are many of these profits, quote-unquote, foreign profits. The only thing foreign about them is that they were taxed in a foreign location and held there. So the Win America coalition is asking for a one-time repatriation 5% tax rate instead of the normal 35% that no American companies have paid for 50 years. That study came out a few weeks ago. So they want 5% tax rate, but they did this shenanigan. This thing's already happened before. There was another ad hoc group, and they accomplished what they wanted. In 2005, it was called the Jobs. It was called the Jobs Act. It wasn't just the Jobs Act, but it had Jobs Act in it. And it was basically allowed $325 billion to be repatriated at 5%. Subsequent studies showed that 90% of the money went to stock buybacks, dividends, and mergers and acquisitions, where the first two were completely prohibited by Congress. They said, we don't want to give you guys all this free money. You'll just give yourselves a bunch of bonuses, dividends, and, you know, buy back your stocks. So they said, you can't do that. And they did it anyway, on more than 90% of the money. And the major proponents behind this Win America started eliminating jobs in 2005. You know, even before the recession hit in earnest, you were talking about massive layoffs at these same companies that, you know, just repatriated hundreds of billions of dollars. I think that act alone empowered them to double down and siphon and channel even more money overseas. The rate is astounding of corporate tax avoidance. It's hundreds of billions of dollars a year.
Well, wouldn't the idea behind a one-time repatriation holiday be that, after that first year where they get a repatriation holiday, that then they have to pay taxes as a normal corporate entity? And might that not be a stimulus to end the offshoring of profits and you know, avoiding taxes, so that this would be an incentive for these corporations to stop hiding their profits and to start paying fairly, and that this would be kind of pushing them to do that? Because wouldn't the argument go that if they don't have this repatriation holiday, then what's the incentive to ever come back and pay their fair share of taxes?
Right. I mean, the thing is, there are separate laws that, fortunately, they didn't get passed, which would have slightly, you know, slowed down the rate of corporate tax avoidance. But, you know, with this One America coalition, that wasn't part of the game at all. It was, you know, here's $325 billion you held overseas. Can we get it at 5%? You know, we promised to do the right thing with it. And they bring the money back overseas. They bring the money back to the U.S., and they said more than 90% went to just paying the executives dividends and buying back their own stock, which just boosts the stock price. You know, so there was no effort in it at all, really, to curtail the practices in the future. On the contrary, the fact that these companies just were able to already siphon off some money, then get a 5% tax rate, if I was a corporate planner, the tax planner, you got to say, wow, we got away with it once. We should avoid even more money and lobby for another holiday in the future. Hmm. So that's what they're doing now.
Amazing. Very, very interesting to see where the real power is in this government right now. We are allegedly a republic, government of by and for the people, but the power of the wealthy plutocrats is really astounding here. And they're telling us to fix the debt. And let's talk a little bit about the debt itself, how much of a real problem it is. Many economists argue that the debt is not a genuine problem, that it's really an invented crisis. Others point out that our debt is historically high and that we have to do something. And again, Robert Kuttner pointed out that in 1945, the debt ratio was much larger than today, 120% of gross domestic product versus today's 72%. But he also goes on to say that anybody in that period of time urging that the main economic issue was the debt ratio would have been laughed out of town. The main issue was how to bring jobs up. What can you say about whether or not the debt crisis, I mean, how real it is? We have a very big debt now, and people are starting to be concerned about that. Is it an invented crisis, or, you know, what's your sense, Mark Provost, of what the real debt problem is or is not?
I think the U.S. debt right now is historically high, but it's high not just in the government, it's high in the private sector, high for households and for corporations. The question is, if we're going to say the U.S. debt is at crisis levels, we need to have some real-world confirming economic facts that would suggest that. One of those would be high interest rates. You know, when you get into a debt problem, you get high interest rates. On the contrary, U.S. interest rates right now are at record lows. So, you know, we don't necessarily have a spike in interest rates whatsoever. So no debt problem there. So it's really one of these things. I look at the example of there's a couple of examples. I'll use those counterexamples. Japan in the 90s, they had a humongous stock and real estate bubble that burst. It was much larger than the U.S. You're talking about a 90% decline in real estate values in the major Japanese cities in a period of a few years. The Japanese crisis of the early 90s was no joke whatsoever. Japan fed its zombie banks just like we did. You know, they kept propping up these, you know, banking institutions that couldn't do anything more than just barely survive. So they did the same mistake there, but they did something different, and the consequences are drastically different for the U.S. and Japan. Japan's unemployment never really increased above 4%. I think it might have spiked to 4.5% for a period of a few months, but the so-called Japan's lost decade, it boasted an unemployment rate that was lower than most of the world, and right now it's still at around 3 or 4%. So, and how did they do that? Huge fiscal stimulus, hundreds of trillions of dollars in yen, and they defied the IMF, which told them they have a debt problem. They said, look at how much debt you have. You're going to have to do cut back. You're going to have to do some cutting, you know, to embrace austerity. Japan didn't do that, and they kept spending, and it helped provide for economic growth. It was subpar, but there was economic growth. and an employment situation that couldn't be any different than U.S. unemployment. So clearly, if the solution is to create jobs, you can do it through fiscal stimulus. The second that Japan tried to pull back, they tried to pull back just like the U.S. did back in 1937. They tried to focus on just the debt, so they cut back spending. The economy went down, and debt actually increased because now the tax revenues declined. So in the Japan situation, they didn't do everything right. They in fact did some things horrible that we did, but on the fiscal side, they did 180 difference than we did, and the employment situation could not be any different from Japan and the U.S. Most Americans would do backflips to live in a Japan employment scenario.
Yeah, 3%.
And Ecuador is a similar case. The president just got Rafael Correa,
yes,
newly reelected president of Ecuador, and everyone's talking about how he's going to be deficit spending, and he has been deficit spending. So Ecuador, small South American country, its unemployment rate right now is 4%. And how did they do that? They overhauled their financial system and huge fiscal stimulus. The question is, what is the major problem?
Right.
U.S. debt or U.S. employment? And I'm of the camp that says U.S. employment and wages are far and away more important to an overall economic indicators of health than just pure, debt levels. Japan's debt's at 200%. They still have record low interest. And so I think that the U.S. today, if there were political will for it, could spend $1 trillion directly on job creation over the next year and a half, and interest rates wouldn't rise. That's my idea.
Well, it seems, you're far from the only one advocating that. And we talk about austerity programs. We've seen situations in parts of Western Europe, Portugal, Greece, Italy, where the plutocrats come into power and create major austerity in the stated goal of reducing the debt and addressing the deficit there, but it causes more unemployment and more instability. And I wonder about, the policies that this group Fix the Debt is advocating, what their actual effects would be if they would actually, in fact, never mind, whether it's humanitarian or not, whether it's mean-spirited or not, does it work? I mean, they want to propose cutting the budget very severely in this rather depressed economy. And some have argued that by doing so, what Fix the Debt is trying to do, actually, by slowing growth even more, creating more unemployment, actually worsens the debt ratio. So what Fix the Debt is advocating, does it even work?
Well, if it's the ostensible goal to reduce the debt, I would say no. However, if the goal isn't the stated goal, but rather to just increase the amount of in the corporate accounts, then I would say it's probably relatively successful. There's been IMF analysis of austerity, and similarly, it shows that the effects of austerity are lopsided. The effects to profits are short term and slight, whereas the effects on wages are longer term and persisting and a bit deeper. So you can see that if you're trying to create a two-tiered economy, austerity is definitely the way to do it. Clearly, if the goal is to stimulate the economy, the austerity is not the way to go. But I've never been of the camp that believes in the ostensible stated purposes of those who preach austerity or the people that are in powerful institutions that are trying to preach it. I think it more has to do with them trying to delimit how citizens think the role of government is. If the whole entire national conversation is consumed with debt and how much sacrifice the people are going to get, they can't even fathom that the government's actual role is to be creating jobs in this scenario. So you've effectively completely dominated the conversation so much so that this word jobs just becomes something that gets clipped on. It doesn't become an actual program for the United States. You know, the dire employment situation in the United States,
right,
and a wage crisis. But, you know, and again, this inequality crisis, it impacts Social Security. A new study just came out by the John Bates Clark Medal winners. They're probably going to win the Nobel Prize in economics. They do the study of IRS tax returns for inequality. And it shows that in the first 2.5 years of the recovery, the current recovery, 121% of the income gains went to the 1%. 121% of the income gains. So the 1% gained 11% in income in a year, and the 99% actually losing income. Well, if you look at the cutoff, the threshold at 330,000, what I mean to say is that entire 11% plus income gain at the top 1%, none of that went to Social Security. Not last year, not 2011, not 2010, and not 2009. So you could see that the 99% not making any more money, in fact losing money, is harming in the short term Social Security, as all the money is basically going into the 200,000-300,000 plus population. So the inequality and Social Security short-term funding problem are the same. And if there were a genuine effort to make Social Security even more liquid and even in a better financial position going forward, raising the Social Security cap would probably be the most effective thing.
Raising the cap, say more. What do you mean?
Oh, well, nothing. There's all income above 110,000 is not subject to Social Security payroll tax.
Uh-huh.
So yes, so this is what I mean, is that all income above 110,000 is not subject to it, and that's where all the income gains have been for the last 3.5 years.
Sure. So if you tapped into that, you'd have a lot more money for Social Security.
Oh, sure, yeah, that'd be the number one way to do it, and I'm much more in favor of doing that.
Sure.
Introducing means testing, which again, I think to some people it sounds kind of nice because you're like, hey, what does a millionaire need?
Right.
You know, $1,000 a month. But much better to just keep the universal aspect of the program and to raise the tax because, you know, if you make $3 million a year, it ends up that your Social Security payroll tax is, you know, 0.002%, a fraction of what, you know, a teacher would pay.
Right. Oh, my goodness. It's kind of hard to believe in some ways that this latest interest group, now calling itself Fix the Debt, there were no labels before and they have other titles, but that their real agenda seems consistently, and it's surprising how stark it is and how open it is, that really they're trying to transform America from a republic serving the people to really a blatant oligarchy where the government just openly serves the moneyed interests. And it seems that these various groups, no labels, the Third Way and Fix the Debt, they're actively involved. That's their real agenda. I mean, you look at some of the people who are involved in that, it does seem, as we said earlier on, very powerful, wealthy interest. Jim McCrary has, you know, a tremendous amount of money. Erskine Bowles, a co-founder of Fix the Debt, was paid $345,000 in stock and cash in 2011 as a board member of Morgan Stanley, which, you know, is only a small portion of his income. Judd Gregg, former Republican senator from New Hampshire, is a co-chairman of Fix the Debt. He's a paid advisor to Goldman Sachs. Both companies, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, you know, not particularly loved by the American public for good reason. They've been engaged in lobbying on international tax rules, and they always lobby to preserve tax breaks for the corporations. It's amazing that I don't know, people can somehow fall for this. And if you were to go to just to any little, you know, mom and pop grocery store or a sandwich shop, any small business, they will say that what we need is to stimulate demand so that people buy more sandwiches and, you know, they buy more stuff. They go into stores. That way we can collect more taxes from these people, and that will help, you know, wipe out the deficit. But I don't see people talking too much about that. During the recent campaign in 2012, I heard people saying, oh, this stimulus doesn't work. You know, Obama just blew $800 million, and what did it get us? It didn't get us anything. How can the government stimulate the economy? Some people feel like, oh my goodness, how can the government spend this money? We're in a debt crisis now. What are you talking about, spending more money you know, having much greater stimulus than even Obama has done? What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it. When I was talking about how I think the domination in the conversation about debt, some of the fix the debt people, they win because at the jump, at the outset of a conversation, they'll ask most Americans, well, do we have a debt problem? And most Americans just say, well, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I attended the Comeback America initiative, which was just this before this Fix the Debt with David Walker. And he asked the room, you know, do we have a debt problem? And I didn't want to be a troll, so I wasn't going to raise my hand and disagree. But somebody else actually raised their hand and said a little something and gave me enough to raise my hand. And I said, no, we don't have a debt problem. I said, what about Japan? And he immediately, you could tell he wanted to change the subject really quick. Because, you know, you look at real-world facts, there's counterexamples. Japan is a currency issuer just like the U.S. You know, when people say, oh, well, I'm in debt. Well, yeah, the difference between a household and an individual and a government is, well, the government issues its own currency. you can pay that debt back with that currency. So the analogy between governments and households is flawed fundamentally. But more to the point, Japan proved that, you know, a country can have 200% debt to GDP, and not only did its trade surplus, Japan's trade surplus is one of the biggest in the world, and that's even despite a strong yen. So they had no currency devaluation, they had no inflation, no spike in interest rates, none of the things that we're supposed to fear about this so-called debt crisis that's going to approach in the U.S., and it never will approach. Even when the U.S. had its credit rating downgraded, right? People say, people remember that from last year during the last standoff in Congress. And what happened is S&P, which is a fourth-tier bond rating agency anyway, no one cares about them because Fitch is the leader there. So S&P comes out, downgrades U.S. debt based on a faulty analysis by one trader. Well, you'd expect if you get your credit rating downgraded, like you personally or me, we'd have a higher interest rate. No, what happened is the investors, the market investors in the world that move their money all the time, they looked at the economy, and then, like it is now, it was slow, and it was scary, and they didn't want to be in stocks or developing markets or oil. They were so scared about the slow economic performance that they ran and poured all their money into U.S. dollars, thereby driving U.S. interest rates to a century-and-a-half low 4 days after we had our credit downgraded. That's how much of a non-crisis we have. No one ever said that. They go, oh, did you hear U.S. got their credit downgraded? I said, yeah, well, you might have heard of that. Did you hear that our interest rates now are at a two-century low because the whole thing scared people and got people upset about growth? And, you know, the people with money, hundreds of billions of dollars on the line, who know what they're doing and they don't want to lose their money, they poured it all into the U.S. right after that analyst came out with that report because it's the safest place in the world to have money. And so there's no debt problem. On the contrary, the U.S. has a real big employment problem. So that's even a little bit bigger than some of the European countries outside of, say, Portugal and Ireland in the very worst hit areas of Europe. Almost the entirety of the mainland has half the unemployment as the U.S. So, you know, U.S. employment and wage debt are just really devastating. And I think that's where policymakers know they should be focusing. That's what voters have been telling them they should be focusing. And yet they want to make it a story about debt. So clearly there's an agenda going on.
Interesting.
It's not to serve the people, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like just really, really clearly to change the conversation away from job creation, which there's no question improves the economy. I mean, people can argue till they're blue in the face that that the New Deal, the significant stimulus in rebuilding the infrastructure of this country, didn't end the Depression. Well, it did. The biggest spending of all was for the war. It wasn't the war itself. It was the spending for the war, that the massive spending for the war that got us back in terrific economic shape. And you know, it had to happen. The idea that people want to be focused, steered to looking at the debt and not employment. It's pretty, I don't want to say sinister, but that's the word that comes to mind, I have to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's part of it because if you look at the situation in the U.S. with this low employment, low wage scenario, it's actually, you know, led to a really high corporate profits, you know, record corporate profits.
Oh, yes.
That's what my analysis shows. Other people say, you know, the corporations are just making more money overseas, or, you know, they're just investing more wisely in machines. But, you know, I think analysis shows that the record low wage growth of the last 4 years and 10 years is directly related to the record profit growth in the last 4 and 10 years as corporations get more and more and more share of the national income. That's a huge problem because, you know, the people with the propensity to spend the money aren't making the money. So, you know, what you're going to have
right.
is this massive clot of capital at the top.
And
I think that's what that $1.7 trillion held abroad represents. That's what the several trillion held domestically represents. And, if policymakers really sincerely wanted to reduce the national debt, there are several ways they could do that. And they could do it with a Wall Street trading tax, which has been embraced by all of our trading partners. As well, and also a carbon tax, which is being embraced by, again, more advanced countries. And there's also just the corporate tax loophole closing, which is at the center of discussion at the G8. France, the UK, and Germany, the leaders from all three countries, just this weekend, have committed themselves to three separate parts of an overarching overhaul of the corporate tax system, because they see it as a detriment to their tax systems. It completely undermines the tax system, the fact that multinationals are doing business in U.S. and Europe and putting their taxes in the Cayman Islands. President Obama has spoke to some of these issues somewhat strongly, but we're waiting to see a little bit more action. But this is just breaking news now that the leaders of the world are done with the corporate tax evasion. So I think it's time for the U.S. to take heed, too.
Yeah, it's amazing how these financial industries that are represented in the leadership of Fix the Debt, they're sitting on something like $1.5 trillion, just not investing it. And perhaps there could be talk about requiring them, somehow providing incentives and disincentives to hoard the money, and, you know, somehow saying we're going to tax that money if you don't invest it. And
there's a retained earnings tax. I can't remember the last time it was instituted in the U.S. Might have been 60 years ago, but other countries do it, but not many countries. But there is something. It's called retained earnings tax. So it's exactly what it is. You want to hoard the wealth, it's going to get taxed.
That makes a lot of sense. And also what we're talking about there, the financial transactions tax, that's starting to gain steam, something like, you know, either a quarter of 1% or a half of 1%. It wouldn't slow anything down. Not at all. It wouldn't make...
Not at all. In fact, it's a sales tax. So people say, well, Wall Street pays taxes. Well, no, they pay a capital gains tax on any realized income, much like any other person would. But if you're going to buy anything in this world, unless you live in New Hampshire, you're going to pay a sales tax. So you go and you buy a T-shirt, you buy a car, you buy a hamburger, you buy French fries, you buy cigarettes, you buy a house. Everything is taxed. So why are Wall Street trading transactions exempted? They shouldn't be. If they had a small marginal tax, like you said, of a half a percent, it would raise several hundred billion dollars a year. I actually think it's only $100 billion a year, but again, over 10 years, it's $1 trillion, and it would have no negative effect on liquidity or trading. It's just one of those cost-free ways to make money. And even some economists like Stiglitz have said that I don't think a small, tiny marginal tax of 0.5% would do it, but that somewhat of a transaction tax can slow the casino. So
yeah.
it can kind of slow down a, you know, wildly out of control bubble frenzy.
And certainly that's one thing that I think all economists agree on, that this whole crash of 2008 was because it was an unregulated wild casino. And these fix the debt once, not even touch that. And as I was promoting this show, I got a message. I promised this person I would ask this question. He asked on Facebook. He said, you can't be serious in thinking any logically conceived taxation on the richest 1% will make a dent in the current national debt. He says, even if they paid 50 or 70% income tax for years, it's peanuts compared to what he alleges is a $16 trillion debt. What's your response to that?
Oh, well, not at all. I mean, the CBO did their own analysis. That's a nonpartisan congressional budget office. And they said the number one contributor to the deficit the last 10 years was the Bush tax cuts. So, I mean, clearly, that's
unimpeachable.
Yeah, what the person said is not that's not the case. It's just, again, just evidence is clearly there. The wars, the economic slowdown itself, the Bush tax cuts, and the Medicare Part D expansion are the biggest contributors to the deficit. And as far as the 1% not having money, I think we already talked earlier about how the 1% now are getting 121% of income gains. So to suggest that they don't have money is not true.
Well, I think he's just suggesting that even if they did pay this big tax for years and years, it wouldn't really affect this big alleged debt crisis.
Well, the top 1% get, you know, somewhere around 18, 19, 20% of national income. So, you know, do 20% on a $13 trillion GDP, and you can see how much they make. And then that's separate from, again, the corporations themselves.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about hundreds of trillions of dollars. I mean, hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars. The money is there. We're definitely not broke.
Yeah.
Our country's richer than ever. There's more money around than ever. So the idea that taxing the wealthy and taxing corporations won't solve the debt. I brought up a counterexample, another one, Norway. Tiny little country, and of course they have oil deposits, but hey, so do we. They have the highest corporate tax in the world, right? The highest corporate tax in the world, and they have no debt. And they tax oil profits 78%. Now people can say we don't have as much oil per capita as they do, but we sure have a lot of it. We sure have a lot of oil and gas and land and offshore. And imagine if that was taxed 78%. And imagine if U.S. corporations paid the highest tax in the world. I think those two things alone would provide almost the wipe out the debt.
And I think one could argue quite convincingly that things like oil are really a public utility. We depend on it, and it should absolutely be regulated. We're talking with Mark Provost about Fix the Debt, this latest incarnation of a plutocratic group that's trying to have the rest of us do our share, but not them. And one thing that almost never gets looked at is military overspending. There is the weapons system contractors, not the personnel per se, but the weapons system contractors have been, you know, living off the welfare for many, many years. What does Fix the Debt, do you know, have to say about cuts in military spending? I heard somebody speak a few years ago that something like $65 billion a year is spent on absolutely obsolete weapon system. And what about defense contracts and tax giveaways that perhaps should be on the chopping block?
Well, I think that the efforts of Fix the Debt really are to preserve the really, really nice system of privilege that both corporations in general have had and military contractors specifically. It's not just financial firms on Fix the Debt. Again, it's more than 100 of the most powerful CEOs many of them from Honeywell, which I said before is the 35th largest contractor. Some of them are like Boeing, which do huge, huge contracts with the government. Some of them are like General Electric. And General Electric is, you know, known for their innovation, but they're about a ward of the state. The things that they deal in are energy and environmental technology, aeronautics, communication, and finance. In all of those, you'll see humongous amounts of corporate welfare and tax loopholes. And the Wall Street Journal reported that General Electric, or GE, has paid 2.3% tax for the last 10 years. That's not just one off year, one thing that we're blowing. The average tax rate GE's paid is 2.3% going back 10 years. The amount of federal money they receive is in the hundreds of billions. So these companies should be grateful and should be happy to pay their fair share of taxes since they benefit almost more than anybody in the system. However, they don't want to even contribute to their own success. And I think that fix the debt efforts are mostly to preserve this arrangement in the U.S. that has seen corporations make record profits. And like you said, the military completely out of discussion. But there's nobody on fix the debt talking about military spending. And like I said, in fact, I think most of the effort is to switch the conversation so that, you know, the military has nothing to do with the debt whatsoever.
No.
And anybody who suggests it would be seen as crazy or outside of, you know, outside of a serious debate.
And how is the real debate happening? The debate on the real issues, the military overspending, all, you know, the tax cuts going to the very wealthy and not stimulating the economy at all. There is fix the debt. There are various. I mean, the plutocrats have very effective advocates on Capitol Hill. Is there pressure from the reasonable side, the side that's against austerity, the side that's against, you know, working people taking the hit and the very wealthy continuing to get super benefits? Are there voices for this on Capitol Hill right now?
I'm not sure how much legislative pressure they have, but groups like AARP certainly are going to be, you know, big time players in any kind of change to Social Security. So if you're talking about large interest groups, you know, you're going to be talking about AARP, some of the DC liberal groups. But there's certainly been a lot of writing on the subject of fix the debt, and I think they've mostly got flubbed in the press, pretty harshly. You know, across the spectrum, I think fix the debt's name has been associated with a, you know, CEO group, and that's largely due to you know, liberal outlets and magazines and progressive news and stuff like that getting the word out. But I don't think they're as powerful or as effective when it comes to pressuring legislators.
Well, I certainly hope not. I'd like to see an economic recovery here. And it's amazing to me how virtually no politicians, you know, there'd be deficit peacocks, really, they you know, not really hawks, but just strutting around pretending to do it and not having the courage to do what most people want. I talk to a lot of Republicans who say, yeah, we should have a jobs program. We need to invest in our bridges, which are falling apart, in our electric system. But I don't see people talking about that right now. What do you see on that front?
Well, I think that the biggest problem in the U.S., and I don't want to take credit for this concept at all, but it's something that you would think about regularly. It always comes up to mind, and that is the democratic deficit. And that was coined by Noam Chomsky. And he basically says the issue of what to do about our budget. An overwhelming majority of Democratic voters, it's like 89%, want deep cuts in the military.
Yes.
Now, a majority, but not as significant, of Republicans also want deep cuts to the military. They also want a jobs program at the top of, you know, 3% think that the deficit's the number one problem.
Uh-huh.
You know, 80% think it's jobs. So for the last 3 years in Congress, it's been deficit, deficit, deficit.
Right.
You know, jobs is just a word they throw out. And similarly with the military, you know, the American people, I remember a poll that came out 5 months ago, and it showed this overwhelming majority. The same exact day Congress passed the $631 billion defense bill, and again, which has been completely excluded from any discussion that the U.S. has a debt problem, you know, that has anything to do with the bloated military spending. That's like that's out of bounds for the official conversation. But most Americans want it.
And I wonder, FDR said to there was a Philip Randolph from the Pullman car workers who wanted to end segregation and have equality there. The president said, I agree with you. I want to help you. Now go out and make me do it. And I hope people are doing that, calling Fix the Debt and these other, plutocrats on this and going out on the streets. There was a very good demonstration about the environment just very recently. And are there groups that you can point people to who want to do something about this and raise the voice and talk about, you know, really addressing our spending priorities and helping to improve our national security and national economic security? What groups can you point people to?
Well, I can point people to our own organization. We're called U.S. Uncut, and we started in the spring of 2011, shortly before Occupy Wall Street, and we were a national direct action-based network of activists that were calling out corporate tax evasion. So, you know, we are always pointing out how much money is spent on the drug war, how much money is spent on prisons versus schools. We're always doing budget analysis. So, and we have some actions in the works, but we also like to work with other groups and partner with other groups when they have their actions and stuff like that. But, you know, there's U.S. Uncut. That's the one group that that I'm with.
Okay. Sounds quite reasonable. And I got to end with a quote from Joan McCarter of Daily Coast. She said of the Fix the Debt crowd, they care about the rich people staying rich and siphoning up every bit of public money they can get their grubby paws on. I suspect, Mark Provost, you would agree with that analysis.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Well, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. Very informative, and people can take action and not buy this Fix the Debt garbage. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Burt.
All right, and we'll hear about some garbage from Spirit.